The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. All right, let's start off today with more news from the world of medicine. Counting steps in beating lung cancer. In a recent study, 50 lung cancer patients wore step counters to measure their activity. Those that had been the least active had the worst outcomes once chemoradiation began. 50% of them required hospitalization during treatment, and 55% died within 18 months. Now that's cheerful. Only 9% of those who were more active needed to be hospitalized, and fewer than 25% passed away. Earlier, the same researchers found that patients often walk less during treatment, and indicating that they were at high risk for hospitalization within the next few days, said the study's lead author. If someone's step count decreased dramatically, say from 5,000 to 2,000 steps a day, that could be critical in identifying those who need extra care. And distaste for veggies actually might be genetic. Oh, wait a second. We read this last week. I'm sorry. Ha ha. I knew that looked familiar. Possible new treatment for kidney stones. Researchers have identified an approach they believe will help patients with kidney stones pass them faster and with less pain. In a lab dish, they exposed cells from the human ureters, the tubes that connect the kidneys to the bladder, to 18 different drugs and found two that were most effective in relaxing the cells. Nifedipine, currently to treat high blood pressure, and rokinase inhibitor, currently used to treat glaucoma in animal glaucoma. In animal tests, injecting these two medications together nearly eliminated painful urethral contractions. Next, the researchers hope to test the treatment in humans to determine what doses are needed to help stones pass faster. Altruism fights pain. Helping others make you feel better about yourself, and it can also help you feel better physically. A series of experiments found that people giving blood to earthquake victims said the needle hurt less than those giving blood tests did. Volunteers who helped migrant children experienced less discomfort when their hands were immersed in cold water than those who hadn't volunteered. And cancer patients who cleaned up for others reported less pain than those who cleaned their own spaces. Researchers theorize that altruism tempers negative experiences by giving you a sense of control and meaning. Statins may help prevent glaucoma. Many patients who are prescribed statins to lower their cholesterol don't continue with them because of misconceptions that their risk and failure to appreciate the potential benefits, even those beyond cardiovascular care. For instance, a study with more than 130,000 participants showed that for each 20-milligram increase in total cholesterol, glaucoma risk increased by 7%, possibly due to impaired blood flow to the optic nerve. But people who lowered their cholesterol levels by using statins for 5 years or longer had a 21% lower risk of developing glaucoma. Well, that's good news for me. By itself, glaucoma protection isn't sufficient reason to take statins, but knowing they might spare you from eye problems could help motivate you to stay the course. Alcohol use disorders going untreated. Medications to treat alcohol dependence are safe, effective, and inexpensive, but they are being prescribed to only a small minority of patients. While the stigma surrounding mental disorders has diminished in recent decades, doctors and patients often still don't talk honestly about drinking habits. Predicting chance of coma recovery. Researchers have discovered a new use for the EEG, a widely available technology. It could help predict how likely it is that a brain-injured patient will wake from a coma. An EEG detected brain activity in 16 of 104 unconscious patients. A year later, 7 of the 16 had recovered enough to function on their own for a short time. Nicotine and liquor are worse than caffeine for sleep. If you've ever struggled to fall or stay asleep, you've heard all the standard sleep hygiene advice. Stick to the same sleep and wake times. Establish a bedtime routine. Create a relaxing sleep environment and avoid caffeine in the afternoon. Turns out that last bit might be as much of a problem as other evening habits. A study of 785 African-American adults with no history of sleep issues, 45% reported drinking coffee, tea, or soda with 4 hours of bedtime, at least once in the course of a week. African-Americans have been underrepresented in sleep studies, but are more likely to experience sleep problems and associated health issues. It's interesting. Data from wristwatch sensors showed that the caffeine had no significant effect on how well or how long they slept. However, drinking alcohol or using nicotine before bed reduced participants' sleep efficiency, meaning that the percentage of time they spent in bed actually sleeping was lower. With nicotine use, people also woke up more often in the middle of the night, perhaps because they were experiencing withdrawal symptoms. Subjects who reported symptoms of insomnia during the study were more likely to have used nicotine before bed, which made their insomnia worse, robbing them of more than 40 minutes of sleep. Nicotine use before bed was also associated with symptoms of depression and anxiety, while alcohol and caffeine use were linked to chronic stress. How about some humor in uniform? An Army buddy and some other raw recruits were waiting in line, waiting to be sent on detail. As the officer in charge read off their names, each soldier jumped up and left the room for their new station, except for a guy named Jones. The OIC, that's officer in charge, called out, "Jones! Jones!" But no one answered. After he called all the names, there was still one soldier left. "Are you Jones?" the OIC asked. "Yes," the soldier replied, happy to be recognized. "But everyone calls me Bubba." We were drilling with rifles for the first time when our master sergeant caught one of the ROTC cadets chewing gum. "Cadet," he shouted, "I want you to run to the end of the field and throw your gun over the fence." We were all slightly bemused when he came back still chewing gum, but with no rifle. And here's something I think at least I need, I'm sure everybody does, how to build a better brain. New research has found that boosting your memory and staying sharp doesn't require cutting-edge technology or supplements. The real solution, stick to the basics. Wendy Suzuki was a highly respected brain researcher with her own lab and a string of published studies when a high-energy gym class and a quiet cup of tea changed her neurons and her life. "I just wanted stronger muscles, but after 6 months of aerobic exercise, I noted that difficult mental jobs were easier. I could keep a lot of little details in my mind," recalls Suzuki, 55, a professor at New York University Center for Neuroscience. "It transformed my research. Exercise in the brain is a major focus of my work now, and I exercise almost every day." But that was only the beginning. While on vacation in Bali around that time, Suzuki met a monk staying at the same inn. He was a tea master, and he shared his morning meditation, simply brewing a cup of tea in silence and sipping it without thinking about a million things you have to do today. Suzuki, who had never been a serious meditator, felt invigorated. "Now," she says, "I start every day with a meditation as I steep and sip my tea." The encounter led to a 2019 study titled "Brief Daily Meditation Enhances Attention, Memory, Mood, and Emotional Regulation." The participants who were not experienced meditators benefit from just 13 minutes a day of general breathing and relaxation for 8 weeks. If Suzuki had looked into her own brain after establishing her new routines, and as a neuroscientist she did the rare person who could do it such a thing, she'd have witnessed some amazing things. New brain cells sprouting, new connections, new blood vessels feeding more oxygen and fuel to her neurons, and more brain tissue in the areas involved with learning, memory, and decision-making. Both exercise and meditation, it turns out, can trigger chemical reactions that pave the way for rejuvenation and explosion. Even more astounding, this renaissance, called neuroplasticity, was once thought to happen only in children's brains. But research now shows that the brain can do these tricks at any age. Benefits include improved memory and thinking skills, more creativity, and a reduced risk of dementia. Or, as Suzuki enthusiastically said, you can grow a bigger, happier brain. Lately, an avalanche of new studies is pointing to exactly how to harness neuroplasticity. Advanced brain imaging techniques, among other lab tools, are allowing researchers to get a peek at how everything from sleep to food to physical activity affects your little gray cells. One insight worth mentioning right here, brain plasticity works both ways. About 50% of the things people do every day that affect their brain are toxic, notes cognitive neuroscientist Sandra Bond Chapman, PhD, founder and chief director of the Center for Brain Health at the University of Texas, Dallas. They skimp on sleep, they multitask, they aren't active. Besides changing those bad habits, what can you do to grow your own new brain cells? Hint, Brain scientists don't recommend spending a lot of money on brain training programs or nutritional supplements. Nor do they advocate trying science fictional stuff such as do-it-yourself electrical stimulation. See, snapping your brain, more on that. Fresh from the front lines of brain science, here are simple things you can do to build a better brain. First, eat your fruits and veggies. Participants in a 2019 study who ate more vegetables than fruits boosted their scores on thinking and memory tests. And there's a picture of a tomato, a sprig of what looks lettuce, a bunch of blueberries, and an avocado with the seeds still in it. Yes to green leafy vegetables, no to nootropics. In 2015, researchers from Australia's Deakin University published one of the first studies measuring food's physical effect on the left hippocampus, a seahorse-shaped brain region crucial for memory, learning, and decision-making. It is also one of the first areas to shrink in people with Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. 255 people filled out diet surveys and then underwent magnetic resonance imaging, MRI scans, that measured their brains. 4 years later, they returned for another scan. The study found that the left hippocampus was heftier in the healthy eaters than in the unhealthy ones, regardless of age, sex, weight, exercise habits, or general health. The average difference was 203 square milliliters, nearly one-third of a square inch. Sounds small, but that's room for a lot of extra brain cells, and strong new evidence that eating the right foods and skipping the wrong stuff could help protect against declines in thinking and memory that lead to dementia. Brain-friendly fare associated with bigger hippocampus include fresh fruits and vegetables, salads, and grilled fish. The brain-shrinking diet was heavy on burgers, fries, and soft drinks. Oh, that makes me feel good. Right. As well as sausage, potato chips, and red meat. Well, there goes my brain. Healthy eating doesn't just prevent brain decline. It boosts scores on thinking and memory tests, according to a study published in March 2019. That tracked 2,621 American women and men for 30 years. Plant-based diets have antioxidants and anti-inflammatory effects that may protect against cognitive decline and dementia, says lead researcher Claire McAvoy, RD, of the Center for Public Health in Queen's University Belfast in Northern Ireland. Even a little healthy food goes a long way. According to a 2018 Rush University study that tracked 960 people for 4.7 years, participants who ate just 1.3 extra servings of green leafy vegetables a day, that's 1.3 cups of salad or a smidge more than half a cup of cooked spinach, kale, or collards, demonstrated cognitive abilities similar to those of people 11 years younger. And a January 2020 study at the Journal of Neurology showed that getting just 15.3 milligrams a day of plant compounds called flavanols, the amount in a small green salad plus one cup of cooked veggies and a half cup of berries, was associated with a 48% lower risk of Alzheimer's-like dementia. That's not a lot on a day-to-day basis, says lead study author Thomas N. Hall at MD, a Rush University researcher. If you eat a big salad every other day, throw in some carrots or broccoli at dinner, and snack on some strawberries, then you've got it. How are these power foods working with your brain cells? Animals and test tube experiments check that the components in healthy diets, such as B vitamins, omega-3 fatty acids, and beneficial polyphenols found in plant foods, help new cells make copies of DNA where they divide and multiply. Meanwhile, high-fat, high-sugar processed foods, from packaged meals to chips and candy, harm brain cells by boosting inflammation and leaving brain tissue vulnerable to damage by rogue oxygen molecules called free radicals. This may interfere with brain plasticity, making processed foods an especially potent threat for the developing brains of kids and teens. While food emerges as an important brain protection, experts say brain supplements, sometimes called nootropics, that's N-O-O tropics, aren't all that effective. These pills and capsules may contain vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, and amino acids in addition to herbs, caffeine, green tea extract, mushroom powder, jellyfish protein, or other ingredients. But studies show that they don't activate brain cells in a significantly positive way. Let the buyer beware, said David Hogan, MD, a specialist in geriatric medicine at the University of Calgary. Dr. Hogan authored a 2015 review of brain supplements in a Canadian geriatrics journal and found no convincing evidence of benefits. In fact, at least one ingredient in some of these supplements could harm your health. A study of nootropics at the November 2019 Journal of the American Medical Association revealed that the unapproved drug piracetam was found in 4 out of 5 brands tested at levels that could cause side effects such as insomnia and depression. Exercise moves that reprogram the brain. Most of the time, your brain is the boss of your muscles, directing how you hit a ball, play the piano, or open a cereal box. But when it comes to growing new brain cells, more and more research shows that when you exercise, your muscles, along with your liver and body fat, take charge. When you're active, they send chemical signals telling your brain, hey, it's time to grow. Recent research suggests physical activity has multiple brain benefits, encouraging the birth and growth of new brain cells and the extension of blood vessels that supply oxygen and blood sugar to brain cells. In a 2016 National Institute on Aging study, people who ran on a treadmill for 45 minutes, 3 days a week, boosted their levels of brain-derived nootropic factor, a chemical that acts like fertilizer for new brain cells. After 4 months of workouts, their scores improved on a memory test. Without exercise, Suzuki says, little baby neurons don't get bigger and make thousands of new connections to other brain cells. With exercise, you get fully functioning adult brain cells. Studies suggest that in younger adults, this can add to overall number of cells in the hippocampus, and once age-related brain changes begin, starting in our 30s, exercise helps keep brain cells alive longer and replaces old cells with new ones. It's a good deal. There's evidence that these brain cells are very active, she says. They're excitable, like teenagers, get involved in more memory circuits than older cells do. You get more connections. At any age, you might notice over time that you feel more alert and have an easier time remembering things after you start a new exercise routine. Sticking with it can reduce your risk for dementia. Women who were fit at midlife and stayed fit into their 80s delayed the development of dementia by 9 years in one exciting study, Suzuki says. That's huge. Again, a little goes a long way. If you're inactive, a stroll around the block may be all it takes to encourage neuroplasticity, she says, and every bit counts. In a 2019 Boston University study of 2,354 adults in their 40s through 80s, sedentary people who boosted their daily walking by 7,500 steps or more had bigger brains than those who didn't exercise, equivalent of 1.4 to 2.2 fewer years of brain aging. The more light activity study participants logged, such as doing housework, shopping, gardening, or walking the dog, the greater the overall size of their brains. Sleep. The nighttime brain cleanup. In 2019, Boston University researchers put caps with attached wires on 13 people, sent them to sleep for the night inside a functional MRI machine, and then tracked the electrical activity that naturally ripples across the gray matter. It was like shooting a film of the brain's secret life, and it was a great show. The researchers found that as the brain waves slowed during deep sleep, blood levels dropped in some areas, allowing more of the cerebrospinal fluid that normally surrounds the cushions of the brain to pulse in and out and then recede like an outgoing tide. The watery ballet may increase communications in the slumbering brain. It also might wash away toxins, byproducts left over from a long day of thinking, thought to interfere with memory. The results check new ways to keep restores our little gray cells, long familiar to bleary-eyed new parents, college students pulling all-nighters, and a sleep scientist who study them. Sleep deprivation messes with mental focus, stifles creativity, interferes with recall, and slows reaction times by as much as 50%. The effects are immediate. In a University of South Florida study of 130 middle-aged women and men, missing out on just 16 minutes of sleep reduced their concentration the next day. Sleep changes have also been linked to the development of Alzheimer's disease and dementia, but it's less clear which comes first. In contrast, a good night's sleep doubled volunteers. I'm sorry, I had a small computer glitch there. Sleep changes have also been linked to development of Alzheimer's disease and dementia, but it's less clear which comes first. In contrast, a good night's sleep doubled volunteers' ability to remember words they'd learned the day before, according to a 2015 study from the United Kingdom's University of Exeter. Brain scientist Michael Scullin, the director of Sleep Neuroscience and Cognition Laboratory at Baylor University, believed so passionately in the value of a good night's sleep that he bribed undergraduates with extra points if they got 8 hours sleep a night during exam week. I didn't expect it, but they also scored about 4 points higher before adding the extra credit on their finals in my class, he reports. That's enough to go from a B-plus to an A. Even I was surprised by the power of sleep. To ensure that you get enough sleep, 8 hours is the magic number for most people. Try to stick with a regular sleep schedule, Scullin suggests. Prime your body clock by getting natural light exposure in the morning and by relaxing at night. And if your bed partner tells you you snore loudly, tell your doctor. Obstructive sleep apnea can cause risk for brain threats like high blood pressure. You may be surprised by the wide range of brain-powered benefits you reap from getting enough sleep. Every aspect of brain health is related to sleep quality and quantity, Scullin says. We even found in a recent study that people were less likely to forgive each other when they got 6 hours of sleep than when they got 7.5 or 8 hours. When I see all of the impulsive, aggressive, negative messages people send to one another, especially on social media, I have to wonder if lack of sleep isn't part of the reason. Would we be more civil, more willing to listen as a society if we got enough sleep? Change your brain the smart way. Human intelligence comes in two varieties. There's dependable, reliable, crystallized intelligence, which draws on the knowledge you've learned. Then there's creative, fluid intelligence, a jazzy superpower that calls on abstract reasoning, working memory, mental focus, and other cerebral talents to find out-of-the-box solutions. So imagine the excitement in 2008 when the University of Michigan scientists announced that brain training games could boost fluid intelligence. Since then, the brain training industry has grown into a $1.9 billion behemoth that promises to tune up your thinking, enhance memory, and even stall declines that lead to dementia. But brain training may work only for some people. In a 2020 study, Wayne State University neuroscientists measured fluid intelligence gains in 424 people ages 18 to 44 who performed various combinations of brain training, mindfulness training, and aerobic exercise for 16 weeks. 282 also had brain scans. A majority, 74%, improved their fluid thinking and a little more, 9% got worse. Just 17%, including people from the groups that got brain training, improved significantly. In this group, some brain areas involved in fluid intelligence, including hippocampus and the larger anterior cingulate cortex, were bigger than average, though few were actually smaller. Without getting a brain scan, how do you know if you're one of the 17% who might benefit a lot from brain games, along with exercise and mindfulness? Your attitude might be a clue. If you already love playing brain games, this will probably help. And there's a picture of somebody dropping marbles into a jar and that apparently indicates a brain game. I'm not sure why. You have to increase levels of the feel-good brain chemical dopamine in order to generate brain cell growth, explains neuroscientist William Shankel, M.D., medical director of Pickup Family Neuroscientists Institute of the Hoge Hospital Network in Newport Beach, California. Don't do things that you don't like because they're supposed to boost brain power. Pick something you love. Keep learning about it and doing it. It takes passion to get benefits. Over time, people will keep their minds active, has slower declines in memory and thinking. They build cognitive reserve, which helps the brain find work and sounds find workarounds even when there are physical signs of Alzheimer's disease and dementia. So what do you like? Do what you like. A study of 1,091 older adults found that playing old-fashioned games such as cards, bingo, and chess several times a week was linked to sharper thinking and memory skills, on a par with a 1.4 higher IQ in a Mayo Clinic study. People who kept up with arts and crafts such as sewing, woodworking, and painting were 45 to 73% less likely to develop mild cognitive impairment over 4 years. Focus counts too. Chronic multitasking and constantly switching Your attention from one thing to another disrupts the memory foundation system in your hippocampus, Chapman explains. Allow yourself to focus on just one thing and go deep. This can change brain structure and brain function for the better. Calm down. While you're at it, try meditation. It may give the brain a helping hand by calming stress circuits that link up areas involved with memory and thinking. Suzuki explains, in a 2013 study from the University of California, Santa Barbara, college students who learned to meditate had better mental focus and got higher scores on graduate school exams than non-meditators. Yoga also encourages brain plasticity, according to a 2019 University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign review of 11 brain imaging studies. People who practice Hatha Yoga tended to have a larger hippocampus, amygdala, the area of the brain involved in coping with emotions, and prefrontal cortex, involved with planning and making decisions. Yoga's brain-changing power may come from its mix of exercise with deep stress reduction. The researchers note, you can sit still, breathe, and reap brain plasticity benefits, Suzuki says. If you're new to meditation or yoga, start small. You don't have to meditate an hour. Even 10 minutes can be too long at first. Start with 1 minute. Find style of meditation you enjoy. Zapping your brain. What about hacking your brain with an at-home electrical brain stimulation kit? Officially known as transcranial direct current stimulation, TDCS, mind zapping with the low-power currents has been shown to have positive effects on memory, creativity, and attention in recent studies. Now a fan of the curious is growing for do-it-yourself IDC TDCs. You can buy a kit complete with wires, stick-on sponges, you soak them in salt water so they carry the current to your skull, and a small plug-in battery-powered electrical source for as little as $99. A Reddit.com forum for TDCS has more than 13,000 subscribers who report mixed results. But TDCS home units are not FDA approved for brain stimulation. A 2019 review in the journal Neuron found that little scientific evidence backs up most devices' claims. And a group of neuroscientists who study electrical brain stimulation warned in a 2016 letter in the Annals of Neurology that zapping your brain on your own could have harmful effects that no one has yet studied. Besides, why take a chance on an unproven brain boost when science has found so many easier, safer, and cheaper ones that do the trick? And with that, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. And one of the editions they have has an article on how to eat less plastic. Bet you didn't know you ate plastic on purpose, did you? Actually, you do. Scientists say that we each may be ingesting as much as a credit card's worth of plastic a week through contaminated food and water, and the likely detriment of our health. Learn how to minimize your exposure, and that's what we're going to do right now. Plastic may be one of the world's most ingenious inventions. The first company to ever sell fully synthetic plastic, the Bakelite Corp., established in 1922, advertised it as the material of 1,000 uses. They had that right. Today, beyond the plates we eat from, the straws we drink through, the furniture we sit on, and the toys our kids play with, there is plastic in the clothes we wear, in the cars we drive, even in the life-saving medical equipment in our hospitals. And more than anywhere else, plastic is in our packaging, encasing everything from laundry detergent to prescription pills, from the food we eat to the beverages we drink, not to mention the fact that we get magazines wrapped in plastic, too. In fact, the world has produced more than 10 billion tons of the stuff, mostly since the 1950s, and we just keep making more. In 2018, manufacturers created almost 400 million tons of new plastic, and production is expected to almost quadruple by 2050. The vast majority of that plastic eventually ends up piled up around the planet. Some of it may last for hundreds of years, and when it does break down, it can become small particles of plastic, microplastics, that spread farther across the planet, entering our water and food supply. Why is this a problem? After all, manufacturers and certain regulatory agencies have long assured us that plastics are safe for human health. In the U.S., we have a robot system that looks at materials that are in contact with food, and that includes plastics, managed by the Food and Drug Administration, says Karen Schmidt, Senior Director of Regulatory and Technical Affairs at the American Chemistry Council, an industry group that represents plastic and chemical manufacturers. Consumers should feel very confident using any plastic coating coming into contact with the food that they would buy in a grocery store. And yet there's growing concern it's not just the photos of whales, albatrosses, and sea turtles washing ashore, stomachs clogged with the stuff, or the stories about swirling ocean vortexes collecting litter from around the globe, although these are sobering. Reliable research now shows that tiny bits of plastics are in our food, drinking water, the air we breathe, and yes, inside our bodies. The credit card here. This is how much plastic you are consuming every week, said Senator Tom Udall, Democrat from New Mexico, holding up a Visa card, and then announcing legislation meant to reduce plastic pollution this past summer. He was referencing a preliminary estimate of some scientists that the plastic the average person may be eating and drinking totals as much as 5 grams per week. One research review published in 2019 calculated the average American eats, drinks, and breathes in more than 74,000 microplastic particles every year. Some scientists say it's likely that ingesting these tiny bits of plastic could expose us to harmful chemicals. There cannot be no effect, says Peter Myers, Ph.D., founder and chief scientist of the nonprofit Environmental Health Sciences and an adjunct professor at chemistry at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. People have this idea that plastic is clean, a sterile object that doesn't come apart, says Sherry Mason, Ph.D., sustainability coordinator at Penn State Barron in Erie, Pennsylvania, and a chemist who has studied the presence of plastic in tap water, beer, sea salt, and bottled water. But in fact, the raw materials of plastic are created from fossil fuels, including oil and natural gas. And thousands of chemicals, depending on the product, are used to make it harder, softer, or more flexible. These chemicals include bisphenols, such as bisphenol A, BPA, and phthalates, which can flow and leach into fluids touched by plastic, especially when that plastic is warmed. It's ironic that as public attention on this issue is really growing, global plastic production is increasing, says Judy Denk, a former regional administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency, now a visiting professor at Bennington College in Vermont, and president of Beyond Plastic, a nonprofit focused on ending the plastics pollution. And as more plastic is produced and discarded, contaminating our water, food, and our exposure levels for the average person will continue to rise. The menace of microplastics. Any plastic item, bag or bottle, toy or chair, starts to come apart with use and time. Breaking down into tinier and tinier fragments, most of the plastic ever produced hasn't been recycled. But it's not just old plastic that is disintegrated into particles that make their way into lakes, rivers, and oceans. Cracking open a brand new plastic bottle or tearing a wrapper off a sandwich releases fragments of plastic that we might end up ingesting. Household dust can be full of microplastics, and it's possible that you might kick up this into the air from your carpet and breathe it in. Plastic fibers even have wash-off clothes into our water supplies. Fragments of plastic smaller than 5 millimeters in length are known as microplastics, and scientists have started to refer even more microscopic fragments, generally smaller than 1,000 nanometers. It's nanoplastics. In a 2019 report, the World Health Organization found that we're unknowingly ingested microplastics for decades without clear negative consequences, saying that research into potential health effects is needed. While there's much we don't know, we have learned that the microplastics and nanoplastics are everywhere. Snow in the Arctic carries substantial amounts of microplastic, according to a 2019 study in the journal Science Advances, and even more has been detected in the Alps. Microplastics can even be found in seemingly pristine sand of Hawaiian beaches. Given this, researchers are concerned that these plastics can make their way into tissues of our body. According to Linda Birnbaum, Ph.D., the recently retired director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and the National Toxicology Program, nanoplastics can easily cross all kinds of barriers, whether it's the blood-brain barrier or the placental barrier, and get into our tissues, Birnbaum said. Breathing in nanoplastics might introduce them into our cardiovascular system and bloodstream, for example. It's also possible that nanoplastic particles might create a systemic inflammatory response, according to Phoebe Stapleton, Ph.D., and assistant professor of pharmacology and toxicology at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Her research has previously shown that inhaled metal particles can harm the cardiovascular health of developing fetus. And her animal research has also confirmed that when a mother breathes in nanoplastics, the particles can be found in many places inside the fetus. We know that after exposure, the plastic particles are everywhere we look, Stapleton says. We don't know yet what those particles are doing once they're deposited there. Other researchers, like Byers of Environmental Health Sciences, are concerned that nanoplastics could possibly release harmful chemicals such as BPA into our bodies. Another area of inquiry focused on the fact that microplastics act like magnets for additional toxins, picking up pollutants such as polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, chemicals now banned for manufacturing in the U.S., but still present in the environment. According to Linda Birnbaum, formerly of the NIEHS, if we later ingest or inhale contaminated microplastics, they may release these substances they picked up into our blood or organs, along with whatever chemicals are also in the plastic itself. A tale of chemical harm. No matter what new information scientists discover after the potential danger from microplastics, we already have sufficient evidence that the chemicals found in various plastics can have serious adverse effects on our health, said Leonardo Trasande, MD, director at the Center of the Investigation of Environmental Hazards at New York University, and the author of Sicker, Fatter, Poor, Boughton Harcourt Books, 2019, a book about endocrine disrupting chemicals. Jeez, a lot of big words in this one. What we know now raises serious red flags about chemical use in plastic containers, he says. They affect brain and organ development in children and are linked to infertility and cardiac problems. Around 10,000 adult men die from cardiovascular disease linked to folates every year. There's essentially no limit on the type of plastic that can be produced from thousands of types of chemicals, leading to products that range from flimsy high-density polystyrene grocery bags to bullet-stopping Kevlar. These chemicals are added to different plastics to give them the various properties. Most people are familiar with better-known villains such as BPA, which has been used since the 1950s to make hard, clear plastic like that used for some beverage bottles, and many other chemicals in plastics have been linked to serious health efforts, including other bioswales in the same family such as BPA. These chemicals can seep from packaging into food and then into the human body. The shape and structure of chemicals such as BPA and phthalates cause them to interfere with the endocrine or hormonal system. Why they are known as endocrine disruptors. Tiny amounts of hormones, measured in parts per billion or even per million, trillion, can affect the functions of a wide range of systems. Treatment is antibodies. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble reading this. The print is very small, and I'm having a little trouble focusing on it today. My apologies. Tiny amounts of hormones, measured in parts per billion or even per trillion, affect the function of a wide range of systems throughout our bodies. And that's what makes even a low dose of BPA or other endocrine disruptors a focus of medical concern. Bisphenols are believed to affect reproduction. Some experts have suggested a link to the significant decline in sperm count in high-income countries over the past few decades. And there's also concern that they may affect brain development and the immune system and can increase obesity and cancer risk, especially cancers influenced by the endocrine system, such as mammary and prostate cancer, says Laura Vanderberg, Ph.D., a Medicare professor at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst School of Public Health and Health Sciences. Phthalates are also known to disrupt hormones, and a prenatal exposure to phthalates is associated with lower testosterone in males. Styrene and other chemicals found in plastic and food packaging has been linked to nervous system dysfunction, hearing loss, cancer, and more. Wow. BPA is the poster child for these types of chemicals, says Patricia Hunt, Ph.D., a professor at Washington State University School of Molecular Biosciences in Pullman. The outcry around BPA created enough consumer pressure that by 2008, some manufacturers started to remove it from certain products. However, when companies removed it, they often replaced it with other chemicals that are often structurally similar to BPA, such as bisphenol and bisphenol E. We're starting to realize that the BPA replacements have very similar biological effects as the original chemical, Vandenberg says. That means a product touting the BPA-free status might be just as harmful. Worse, their replacements face less scrutiny, a byproduct of the last regulatory framework in which we live, says Tresande, who describes the efforts to keep up with such replacements as a chemical whack-a-mole. Recent research has also revealed that we may just have underrated our exposure to these chemicals all along. Hunt says, scientists have typically measured the presence of BPA in our bodies by analyzing the products that metabolize BPA in urine and converting them back into the original substance. These efforts found BPA in more than 90% of the people studied. Hunt and colleagues here developed a new way to directly measure not just the BPA in the urine, but also in its metabolic products processed by the body. In doing this, they found that BPA levels in the human body that may be 44 times higher than a national survey found using the older method. Our exposure to other chemicals has naturally been measured in the same indirect way, Hunt says. That may mean we're also underestimated our exposure to phthalates and other chemicals of concern. Our data is suggesting that some people and pregnancies, some fetuses, are in the less exposed quite high levels of BPU, he says. The non-plastic path forward. If chemicals and plastic have been linked to all these health concerns, many people will ask why the FDA permits them to be used in food packaging. Vandenberg says that's because there are flaws in our regulatory system. We often don't know which chemicals are being used because the FDA doesn't require companies to release toxicological data on all chemicals that can transfer into food, according to a consensus statement published in March in the Journal of Environmental Health. As new chemicals get put onto the market, we have to know that they're there, before they can even be assessed for risk, Vandenberg says. Yet perhaps the most fundamental problem, Tresande says, is that our federal agencies use risk assessment method that hasn't been updated since the late 1950s. It measures the dosages of high doses of a chemical, but doesn't account for the fact that low doses may have different harmful effects. Those old methods are good for calculating what happens if you're exposed to a high dose of a chemical, like if you fall into a vat of it, Vandenberg says. But as the statement in Environmental Health says, they don't take into account what we've since learned about how low doses of chemicals over time can affect the endocrine system and disease risk. The agency's safety reviews continue to be conducted based on long-standing academic standards and demonstrated principles of toxicology and chemical safety assessments, as a spokesman for the FDA. As plastic production continues to rise, assessing whether our current system is protective enough has become more urgent than ever. Nearly 200 nonprofits have released a call to action, asking regulatory bodies around the globe, such as the FDA, to create a system that's more transparent about the chemicals and packaging and that takes a more restrictive approach toward the sorts of chemicals allowed. Half the plastics ever made was made in just the last 13 years, says Judith Inc., a former EPA regional administrator. To reverse the trend, to make concerned effort from many quarters, with people arriving and striving to use less plastic, companies committing to efforts that would truly improve and reset cycling, and legislation that would eliminate most single-use plastics, such as shopping bags, the health and environmental reasons. Each supports Senator Udall's newly proposed Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act, which would phase out all single-use plastics, put a pause on the loss of new plastic production, and require sellers of plastic to cover the cost of collection and recycling. We have a fighting chance to stop this, she says. Plastic Through the Ages, 1869. John Wesley Hyatt, a printer, develops celluloid, one of the first forms of plastic made by modifying natural materials. His aim was to win a $10,000 prize offered by a billiard ball manufacturer to come up with a cheaper way to make balls, which at the time used ivory. In 1907, chemist and inventor Leo Baekeland invents Bakelite, the world's first synthetic plastic, meaning it contained no molecules found in nature. The heat-resistant substance proves to be particularly useful to the electrical and automotive industries and were soon used in radios, cars, teleprompters, telephones, and other products. In 1939, the world's first fully synthetic fiber, nylon, is developed by Wallace Carruthers, Ph.D. at DuPont. It was the first used in some women's hosiery, but after the U.S. entered the World War II in 1941, it was quickly channeled into the war effort to use in parachutes, ropes, tents, and a B-29 bomber tires. 1939 also, Pontiac's famous show model, made mostly out of a new plastic called plexiglass, which was designed to be hard as transparent and hard to shatter, is displayed at the World of Tomorrow exhibit during the 1939 World's Fair in New York City. In 1941, with the Defense Department requisitioning metals like aluminum and steel for World War II war effort, plastic parts and consumer products such as refrigerator trays and door handles became increasingly common. In 1949, dolls are increasingly made from plastic. CR says in an article about gifts at Christmas shopping guide, up to this point, most dolls had been made in China and then from a resin mix in the 1940s. In 1951, Consumer Reports newly popular plastic dishes for the first time to see how tough they are. The conclusion? They're easily melted, scratched, and stained. Also in 1951, saleswoman Browning Wise, who pioneered the concept of Tupperware parties, becomes vice president of the new formed Tupperware Home Parties, in which saleswomen could demonstrate products in consumers' homes. Wise is credited with transforming a heretofore unsuccessful product, Earl Tupper filed the product for the product in 1947, into a staple of American life. In 1956, a Life magazine article featured an array of disposable paper and plastic items, such as plates, buckets, maps, even a hunting decoy, with the head first, throwaway living, disposable items come down household chores. And in 1957, plastic sandwich bags and supermarket plastic bags on a roll are introduced. 1963, plastic wrap is first rated by CR. We found that it provides a tighter seal than aluminum foil or wax paper. Space blankets, made from plastic insulating materials developed for space missions, go on sale to consumers. CR's assessment is that these could work well as a windbreaker or sunshade, but could not replace a sleeping bag while camping because they couldn't be warm enough. In 1957, the graduate Dustin Hoffman's character, Benjamin Braddock, received some famous career advice from an older mentor. Just one word, plastics. That's a great future in plastics. In 1973, Nathaniel Wyeth, an engineer for DuPont, patents polyethylene tetraethylate, PET, plastic to soda bottles, the first and capable of holding carbonated veggies. 1982, the first artificial heart successfully implanted in a human. the Jarvik 7 made primarily of polyurethane plastic. In 1988, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, a region of the ocean that naturally accumulates debris, much of it plastic, because of swirling currents is more than twice the size of Texas, is first described by researchers in Alaska. In that same year, 1988, an industry group launches the triangular recycling sods still seen on products today to make it easier to sort containers. In 1998, researchers link biophenol exposure to health problems in animals, including reproductive dysfunction and prostate changes in mice. These researchers raised some early concerns about the potential human health effects of BPA on adults, developing fetuses, and young children. In 1989, CR warns parents about gethathalone and BPA in plastic children's products. 2002, Bangladesh is among the first countries to ban the thinnest plastic shopping bags after discovering that bags clogged the drainage ditches and worsened devastating floods. In 2007, San Francisco became the first U.S. city to ban single-use plastic shopping bags. By 2020, the rest of California, seven other states, and many cities have all followed suit. 2012, the FDA prohibits the use of BPA and baby bottles and sippy cups. 2014, Dutch researchers successfully placed the skull of a 17-year-old woman with a plastic 3D printed, that's interesting, replacement. And in 2020, sometimes call our present era the Anthropocene, the geological time that humanity reshaped the Earth with its climate. Within that era, some think future scientists might look back on us starting in the 1950s as the plastic era defined by the enormous amount of plastics that human beings have brought and layered around the Earth. And one other article to go with this. What's gone wrong with recycling? And if this print gets any smaller, I'm going to have to quit. In the U.S., about 76% of plastic garbage bags go into landfills, where it eventually breaks down into microplastics that contaminate the environment and potentially release problematic chemicals. An estimated 60% more is burned at very high temperatures, which produces greenhouse gases both during the incineration process and when these fossil fuels are used. An additional 1% of that total ends up littering our oceans, where sea life feeds and chokes on it. It breaks down into microplastics that dip up seafood, and it spreads even to the length of the ocean floor. Why is it more plastic recycled? Most plastic is less recyclable than most people think. The very idea that recycling makes plastic use acceptable comes from plastic manufacturers, says Judith Enck, a former regional administrator at the Environmental Protection Agency, now a visiting professor at Bennington College in Vermont, and president of Beyond Plastics, a nonprofit focused on avoiding plastics pollution. The reason the public thinks recycling is the answer is that the plastic industry has spent 30 years on multi-million-dollar campaigns saying that, she says. That was absolutely the wrong message. The message should have been, don't use as much plastic. Most products are composed of a mixture of different plastics with chemicals, which can make recycling impossible. What's more, these products are often covered with food waste that can further complicate the process. Even the two recycling codes considered most recyclable, 1 and 2, are Dow cycling most of the time, which means they're turned into lower quality products that will end up in a landfill because those materials aren't recycled again. Big brands often use cheaper new plastic instead of recycled plastic. Today, the percentage of what's recycled is going down. Much of what's collected now is unlikely to be recycled because in 2018, China, where most of the world's plastic was sent to be recycled, stopped accepting it from other countries. A finger in the dam. There are more program aimed at reducing the avalanche on March 1st, New York State enacted a ban on many of the single-use plastic bags at grocery stores and shops, an effort to cut back on the estimated 23 billion plastic bags New Yorkers use yearly, after a ban in seven other states and a number of cities. Yet while efforts like these are laudable, they aren't enough to overtake the reality that companies keep pumping out more and more plastic. Global plastic production is expected to almost quadruple by 2060, according to a 2016 report from the World Economic Forum. And because plastic is made from fossil fuels such as oil and natural gas, the report calculated by 2050, 20% of all the production of all oil production would be used for making plastics. Plastic profits. Much of the current plastic boom is a result of a technology known as ethane cracking, which uses a byproduct of fracking to create the sorts of product plastics used in packaging, often single-use plastic packaging, according to Inc. A new ethane cracking plant was built by petrochemical companies Shell and Experience to produce 1.6 million tons of polystyrene plastic each year. Plastic production is a way for petrochemical companies to continue to profit, even as countries turn from fossil fuel to renewable energy. Plastics may play an essential role in safety and sanitary food packaging that reduces food waste. And food waste is a huge issue, says Keith Christian, Managing Director of Plastic Markets at the American Chemistry Council, an industry group representing plastic manufacturers. Work needs to be done to dramatically increase plastic recycling, particularly packaging. Our goal is to recycle and recover all plastic packaging by 2040. There's a lot of work that needs to be done to get there. Yet, according to Inc. and other experts, recycling doesn't work if you keep making more and plastic the whole time. You need to make less of it in the first place. You can't recycle our way out of the problem, says Inc., who consumers can pressure companies to keep away from plastics, especially single-use plastics altogether. The only solution is reducing the generation and use of plastics. Very quickly, let's do a couple laugh lines before we close. Deodorant? No, I've never to buy any. People just give it to me. Complete strangers sometimes. Dry shampoo is the equivalent of unicorn blood for hair. It'll keep it alive, but it'll be a half-life. A cursed life. And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.